Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Last week, Lake Effect and WUWM News featured reporter Mayon Silver's series on the issue of human trafficking in the Milwaukee area. It's a significant problem in the area, but so are other sex crimes. Nationally, statistics indicate that nearly 1 in 5 women have experienced rape or attempted rape at some point in their lives.
While April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, the Women's Center of Waukesha works year-round to broaden the conversation and bring greater awareness to sexual violence and the efforts being made to combat it. The center has been in operation for more than 40 years and serves women, children, and men impacted by domestic abuse, sexual violence, child abuse, and trafficking.
Angela Mancuso is the executive director of the Women's Center, and she recently joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss the center's history and how it's adapted over time to help those who need support.
The movement, as it were, really started around the 70s. That's when a lot of domestic violence or sexual assault organizations came about. So they're pretty progressive, though. 5 very tenacious women, so we refer to them as our founding mothers. But, the work that we do today is the work that they articulated in 1977. So I just think that's really cool and an interesting fact about the Women's Center. So what we primarily do is we work with adult and child survivors of domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, and human trafficking. And we do that through a number of comprehensive programs. We have an emergency crisis shelter for individuals who need that immediate safe place to stay. We have transitional living, so that's for individuals that can live in the apartments for up to 2 years and still be connected to our programs. We have a counseling model, so we have counselors who are, trauma-informed, who will conduct one-on-one short-term crisis counseling sessions with adults and for children. So I have adult counselors and I have youth counselors. And then we also do ongoing support groups and topic nights. We do job readiness training and employment counseling and support, and also life skills development. We have a legal advocacy model, so we have advocates that are co-located at the Waukesha County Courthouse and at the Women's Center, and we're really helping with restraining orders or doing court supports. We do children's programming. We provide free child care for anybody who's using any of those programs. And we do a lot of violence prevention work in school. So we've been really busy since 2017, in a lot of middle and high schools where we're talking about healthy relationships, consent, how to work through conflict, things like that. So, and we have a 24-hour hotline. So with all of those programs, a duplicated number will be about 15 or 16,000 a year that we will work with.
And that's a far-reaching impact that goes beyond what people may first think when they hear the Women's Center. They're
Correct.
Probably only thinking of adult women. And although issues such as domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and human trafficking, these aren't new problems. And as you said, you were founded in 1977 and
Correct.
Have the same mission and continue to do so. How have you needed to grow and adapt in order to tackle these issues as they morph or become more pervasive, or there's different ways to spot them or educate people about them?
Right. So our name being the Women's Center, and in 1977, it was, these were considered women's issues. In fact, it used to be called displaced homemakers. That was some of the language. So some of the evolution is that we work with all genders at the Women's Center, and that has been a change over the years, is that statistically speaking, so domestic violence, sexual assault are grossly underreported crimes. The stats that are out there are reflecting data that has been reported, which dictates that still the large percentage of victimizations are women and the large percentage of perpetrators are men. However, that is changing a lot. And that's data that is also pretty specific to when we talk about, let's say, 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime, well, that number is actually significantly higher in communities of color or in the LGBTQ communities. So when you take all of that into account, these are really egregious, prevalent crimes that are happening across all communities. There's no socioeconomic boundaries to these kinds of crimes. And that has been part of the evolution since 1977 is, of course, branching out, serving anybody who has been affected and harmed by these issues, not just women. And I think also human trafficking is another example where it's not a new phenomena. It has a name to it now, and it's certainly is an issue that needed to be brought to the forefront and to be talked about. But really, violence in the home, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, human trafficking have been going on since the dawn of humankind.
Tackling all of these issues, you know, not necessarily tackling them at once, but having the resources to be able to address and help survivors go through every step. Do you find that it's a trend to have, you know, for lack of a better word, a one-stop service center? And how does that impact your ability to minimize further trauma for the people who need these services and establish trust to better serve the community?
Well, we do actually tackle all of the issues at once. Because we have to, you know, that's based off of demand and what who's coming through our doors and what they need. But it has been a trend, I would say, maybe over the last 5 to 8 years, because agencies that are addressing domestic violence or sexual assault, they're complex situations and there's so much that goes into it. I mean, there's the legal system, right? The criminal justice system. It could be child protective services. It could be a school, a hospital, lawyers, supportive agencies. So it can be really overwhelming, especially when you are that individual that has been traumatized and harmed. It can be really overwhelming to, you know, it's like, wait, oh, I have to go there, you know, and it's like all I want is to start on my healing path, you know. So it is a benefit to have as much as you possibly can under one roof. Again, it removes some barriers, right? So for individuals who they don't have a car or they're taking public transportation, or if they're coming from Milwaukee out to Waukesha to the Women's Center, it's just better to have as much as we can under one roof to make things easier. It can be just exhausting, you know, to travel all around to get your needs met. And there are certainly we're not all things to all people. So we try to provide what our clients are telling us that they need. And then what we don't have on site, we're making referrals. But what we prefer to do is bring that outside partner to us. It can also be less intimidating, you know, if people are comfortable. It's a big deal to come forward, right, to seek help. So we're just trying to make things as easy as possible. We provide bus tickets. We provide, you know, cab fare, gas cards. That's why we provide the on-site child care for clients. So, again, we can just try to ease the burden of everything that they have to go through, because the onus really is on them. They have to advocate for themselves. So our role is to be their partner and to provide a foundation, make it as easy and as smooth as possible.
With all of the services under one roof, what kind of tracking or collection are you doing for your purposes of, you know, what areas you have the most concentration of resources? Or do you see, okay, this month or this year we had more percentage of domestic violence clients that we helped, or anything along those lines?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I'm going to say no. I mean, we do lots of data collection. And I guess if we looked at the demand, for instance, our emergency shelter, so that's 32 beds. So we end up turning away a lot of families because we're full all the time. So that would be one sort of trend we would monitor from maybe quarter to quarter, and then, of course, year to year. Like, well, how many families did we have to turn away? Does this mean we have to come up with a different configuration of rooms? Does it mean there's more violence, or does it mean that it's the same amount of violence but people are ready to leave? So, you know, it's sort of the Boolean factor, if this, then that, when we're looking at our data. But there are some consistent trends. I mean, consistently, the largest population we see is, you know, 18 to 30-year-olds. We have seen an uptick in elder abuse needs. We have seen an increase in men needing supportive services from us, either on the domestic violence or sexual assault side. Those are trends that have been going on, I would say, for, you know, the last couple of years. But other than that, these are crimes that are so prevalent and are committed every day in every community, in every subset of every community, that's the trend. You know, it's like it's just keeps happening despite awareness. And people need more supportive services.
And I imagine these crimes can be interrelated also. It's not strictly one branch stays separate. Someone who perhaps experienced domestic violence could also have sexual assault survival stories and all interwoven within each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right, which is why we serve the, you know, when we say we work with survivors of those sort of four categories, if you will, and then within those there's, you know, a lot more detail. But right, domestic violence and sexual assault are highly linked, and child abuse and trafficking can also be linked, or trafficking and domestic violence. I mean, so right, they're all very symbiotic issues.
Where do you believe that the disconnect still remains when it comes to understanding sexual assault and its aftermath? You know, as you mentioned, it goes vastly underreported, with 63% of assaults unreported, and our culture is still one of victim blaming and shaming. There is some movement to change that, but you know, it's not something that can be fixed overnight. So how do you think we can change the way we talk about these issues?
Well, I think you're on point when it doesn't change overnight. I mean, as a society, we're really quick to move on to the next new shiny thing. But real change happens over time, and it's a process. It's not an event. It's not just going to happen. So I think that's part of the disconnect, is that it can seem like a never-ending, exhausting wave of victim blaming and shaming. And when you think about, it seems like we move three steps forward and then it's five steps back. So 2017, right, was the really big year. That was big year for the Me Too movement and everything that was going on in Hollywood and D.C. and lots of awareness, lots of discussions about it. Yet we were busier than ever. So then people would say, well, what happened there? Well, Harvey Weinstein, what does he mean to us? What does he mean to little old me, you know, from Milwaukee? I don't know him. It can be hard to identify. It's like, as a, you know, survivors, you hear about all these issues in D.C. or Hollywood, but how does that relate? Because you have a different community and you're coming at it from a different perspective. So we have yet to have somebody call our hotline and say, hey, yeah, I just saw that my favorite celebrity came forward and said that, you know, they are a survivor, so I'm going to do that too. That doesn't happen, you know, and it's because, again, it's a more personal choice that one makes. But I think when we have something positive like Me Too and lots of discussions, but then we have the Brock Turners and the Baylor University fraternity president literally walking away, and that has a ripple effect on survivors, of course. And those are classic examples of victim blaming and shaming, because it is the victim that has to do all the work. It's the victim that has to prove that they did not want to be victimized. I mean, who does that, right? So we focus as a culture so much on, you won't get sexually assaulted if you don't wear this, if you don't walk there, if you don't drink this much, if you, you know, but really we need to shift all that energy to, here's why you will not sexually assault somebody. Here's boundaries. Here's respect. This is what coping mechanisms are if you don't get your own way. I mean, that's what we need to make this shift towards. You know, it isn't, why did she get raped? It's why did that perpetrator do that?
And you mentioned you're going into schools and having these kinds of discussions, because obviously as we're conditioned to learn these types of behaviors or be blamed for certain types of behaviors, how are you trying to help adults be more aware of and change the way they are speaking about the issues, or even how they speak to a survivor in order to support them?
Right. It's sort of like the walk a mile in their shoes. You know, you really have to, if you are not coming from that kind of trauma, it's really pausing before you speak, really thinking about this. Because it's, first of all, recognizing that it is a huge, it's a big deal when someone discloses to you. And when they do, they've thought about it. And it's very personal and profound for them. And then the friend or family member that they, you know, are disclosing to says, wow, I'm really sorry that happened to you. Why were you walking down the street by yourself? And they don't have malintent when they say that. They're just not stopping to think what that means, how that can alienate their friend, or what did you do to make your partner so mad? You know, it's like, well, wait, I'm just existing. You know, that's what happened, apparently. But it can be very alienating when someone judges. And that's what happens when we say, or the at leasts, you know, the, well, at least you didn't get hurt, or at least you're still alive. Well, okay, that is the least comforting statements to say. So it's just being very mindful of not alienating that individual. So really, you know, again, as human beings, we have this desire to tie everything up in a neat box and rationalize it immediately with what works for us, because especially around sexual assault, it's very hard for everybody to understand and reconcile what that is. And we don't want to believe it's true. We don't want to believe that someone we know has been harmed. So we try to rationalize it away. That's very damaging to that victim. You know, so just don't say a lot. You know, what we say is, you know, if you say anything, just say, I'm sorry that happened to you. Say, I believe you. You can say, when you're ready to talk, I'm here for you. Is there anything that I can do for you right now? And then just stop talking and give that survivor some space, because they may not know what they need in that moment. But if you say things that are very victim-blaming or alienating, you run the risk of really pushing them away from you. And, you know, in domestic violence situations, oftentimes victims are already so isolated from their friends and family, because that's what abusers do. It's a tactic. So then for them to finally come out and say something, and then they just can get pushed into more isolation, and that could be dangerous.
Well, yeah, and to have that misstep also, I think, plays into how people think about a healing process. You know, if they're not coming from it from a sense of empathy and truly understanding or not having a similar experience, they may not understand that the healing is not a straightforward process. So what do you want people to know about that as well?
Right. You know, and that's a great point. You know, that victims know themselves better than anybody else. Even if it's a victim disclosing to somebody who has also had experience that kind of trauma, they don't know better than that individual. I don't know better than the people who are in front of me. And it's really respecting people's space and respecting their process. Everybody's process is different. It is unique. So when people come to us at the Women's Center, they're coming under the same umbrella, right? But their needs are different. Their personalities are different. Their experiences are different. So we don't have a cookie cutter model. It's literally catered and customized to each individual, each child, each family, each adult that is sitting in front of us. And it's based on what they feel comfortable with and what they feel that they're capable of doing at that time. So it could be very small steps, or some people want to take a big leap at a time. But just to respect and understand that it is their own journey. You don't know better than they do, and you can't understand what they have gone through in their own personal experience. They need to feel ready, and people need to feel safe too, you know, and safe on each step of their journey, which is a component that the Women's Center provides. But it's just treating survivors with dignity and respect and letting them choose their own path. That can be really hard for people, especially when you are feeling so bad that something so horrible happened to someone you know. But it's, you know, your role is not the fixer. Your role is the supporter.
Angela Mancuso is the executive director of the Women's Center Incorporated in Waukesha. At WUWM.com, you can find more information about the organization and also its luncheon tomorrow featuring actor and advocate Terry Crews as the keynote speaker via satellite.
We should also mention that if you need help or services from the Women's Center, you can reach out to their 24-hour confidential hotline at 262-542-3828.